This is Mrs. Morley White, and she was a Buck, and she's going to tell us a bit about her history.
I was speaking on an earlier recording, and I'm just going to continue one thing in connection with childhood on Maiden Lane, and that was that as young children, we always had what we called a camp. A camp consisted maybe of two boards on a nailed to a tree, but we thought it was marvelous. And when Gregory House at Netherwood, the house behind the chapel that is soon to come down, the boards were stolen by us in the evening after the carpenters had left, and we would smuggle these into the woods to build our camp. Miss Ganong, the headmistress, found out about this, and she came to my mother and said that if we didn't take any more boards or nails and didn't bother the carpenters and didn't put our feet in the wet cement, that on Halloween, as was the custom at Netherwood, the girls would dress up and have a taffy pull, that we would be guests at the taffy pull. We were all between the ages of 5 and 8. And sure enough, we obeyed, and we had a marvelous time at the taffy pull. Now, to continue about the Brock family, we were a family of 5 children. There was a 6th one, Susan, who died at an early age. And my father was born in St. John, his father before him in London, England. He married in England a Mary Lush. And after 3 children, Maud, Lillian, and Mary, they came to Canada. He was in the wholesale dry goods business, Brock and Patterson on King Street, later to become Vassie Brock Manchester, the same Mr. Manchester that is Manchester Robertson Allison. And he later met Annie Kerr from Scotland. Annie Kerr came out to visit her brother, who was living in St. John, William Kerr, who had a lovely brick home in Mount Pleasant, and met my grandfather. They married and had 5 children, Frederick, Annie Louise, Edith, Charles Harold, my father, and John Daniel, the youngest, who was killed in the war in 1916. My father's father, Frederick William George, built a house in Rothsay directly across from Shadow Lawn. Now, a doctor lives in it, having had many families through the years live in it. Sadly, he never lived in the house. He died before it was completed. And my father, who was then 15 and at RCS, had to leave school and look after his mother and 3 sisters who were not married. 3 of the children, Maud and Lillian and Edith, Maud, Frederick, and Edith, died in a diphtheria epidemic at an early age. Mary married Isaac Moore, who was a headmaster at RCS, and they moved to California. They had no family. My father was married in 1915 to Muriel Gillis, who was born in Ireland, John and Susan Gillis's daughter, and she spent most of her early days in Redhead, growing up, having come to this country at a very early age. It was nothing for my father, when he was courting my mother, to walk from Rothsay to Redhead on a Sunday after church, have afternoon tea with the Gillis family, and walk home again after the evening meal with them as well. While they were engaged, they built the family home on Maiden Lane and were married a year later in 1915, as I said previously. At that time, there were no trees going up the lane. The land had been owned by the Percy Thompsons, who lived in Shadow Lawn. They used to have a lot of Martin bird houses at Shadow Lawn, and I remember growing up with Martin houses on our property as well. My eldest brother, Fred, who died 2 years ago. Then there was John, a bachelor, my sister Eileen, who married George Brown, now a widow and lives in Bedford, Nova Scotia. Myself, I married in 1952 Arthur Lee White from Peru, and my younger sister Bettina, now a widow living in Toronto, was married to Robin Dodds Heffron. My father was a warm-hearted family man. He loved to read. He adored children. He always seemed to love the youngest one. I remember when Bettina, who was the young one until she was 13, suddenly Eileen had her firstborn, Derek, and Granddad's affections were transferred to the new grandchild. I, in turn, was very jealous of Bettina because she was born 4.5 years after I was. We had a very happy childhood. Our father would leave early in the morning to walk to the station and take the early train to St. John, and we wouldn't see him again until 7 o'clock at night. We would go down to the end of the lane. We weren't allowed to cross the road. We'd guess on how many cars would go by before the train came in. We could see the train at the end of the tennis court road, and we would guess who would spot Dad first rounding the corner at the Kennedy House and then walk home with him. And we were promptly put to bed while Mother and Dad had a very late dinner. Those were long, hard days. They worked all of Saturdays, and the biggest treat of the year would always be on July the 1st, Canada's birthday, called Dominion Day at that time. We would start out early in the morning, walk to the station. Dad would get us all on the train. My two brothers at that point owned a small sailboat called the Junco. And on the July the 1st, there was always the Digby race, and they would have left the day before to get the Junco through the falls and be ready to start the race over to Digby. It happened once a year. We would be in on the train, walk up to where the boat left, and on the boat, and it was a long day, when we got to Digby, we would walk to the Pines Hotel, and this was the big treat, have a swim there, and then have lunch, and then start watching for the boats coming. And once or twice, I know, the Junco won the race, which was very exciting. We would pass all these yachts as we went over to Digby, some looking awfully small in the Bay of Fundy. Then when we would get home at night, usually the youngest one asleep, Dad with the baby on his shoulders, we'd walk to the station and take the late train home and walk up from the station. There were no cars in those days. We didn't actually own a car until the war years. Now, Cynthia's asked me some things about our childhood chores. We all had things to do. There would always be a big wood pile, and the boys had to chop the wood. And when we came home from school, we had to put in 100 sticks. We'd throw it through a basement window. I'm sure that window today still shows the scars. And then we'd go into the basement and have to stack it in the wood pile. Everyone had a wooden furnace in those days, and it was the boys' job to empty the ashes. Those ashes pretty well built the road to Morton's house. We kept hens, and John pretty well looked after the hens, had to clean out the hen houses, collect the eggs, feed the hens, put the water out for them. When we came home from school in dandelion season in June, Mother would say she would make a pan of fudge if everybody would each pick 100 dandelions. There was no refrigeration other than a tin icebox, unless you were lucky enough to have a nice house, and then in the winter you would have to collect blocks of ice, bury them in sawdust, and have your own ice. Otherwise, a man delivered weekly, and you had to empty the tray underneath every day in order not to have a flood. People came door to door. There would be the vegetable man, a Mr. Puddington, the fish man, Mr. Gilliland, the meat man, Mr. Dixon. He had a little shop where the Bank of Nova Scotia now stands. A dressmaker would come to the house and stay for the week. We had Hilda Dobbin. She would be an older sister of Peggy Ward. And all our clothes would be made for the summer. And as we got older, sometimes Mother would sit down at the old pedal machine and make 7 dresses for each of the 3 girls, 21 dresses in all, from the same pattern, but various little collars or prints, which made them look different. They were always in a little princess style. And we'd have a fresh dress for every day of the week. We didn't seem to wear shorts or slacks in those days. Now, before winter descended, everyone would have to prepare, and sacks of potatoes were bought by the 100-pound, carrots by the 100 pounds, many squash, turnip, a bag, onions, and we did have a vegetable garden, but these also had to be ordered. There would be two barrels of apples. One barrel was always russets, and these would not be eaten till after Christmas because they kept longer. When we came home from school, we were always allowed an apple. All these things were kept in the larder, a cold room in the basement. Also, the jams and the pickles would be kept there, and Mother would be very busy in the fall, preparing for winter with jams, jellies, and pickles in abundance. In the summer, it was always lined with empty jars. And when you had a roast or chicken, after dinner, there was no refrigerator to put it in, so you carried the platter down the stairs and put it on the cold floor with a big cover over it. There was also a butterman, a Mr. Northrup, and the milkman was George Phillips. Flour would be stored in a deep drawer in the kitchen, a large wooden drawer like a bin on a hinge, and it was bought by 100-pound bags. Eggs were put in crocks in the larder. They would be covered in isinglass, which was cold and slimy, and this would keep eggs for the winter. They would then have a very thin shell. Most people killed their chickens in the fall, so there would be no egg laying through the winter months or chicken to look after. When cooking bacon, you always saved the fat, called the bacon dripping, and it was used a lot in cooking. And in cold winter mornings, it was usual to fry a piece of bread in the bacon drippings to keep you warm through the day. People also saved fat to make soap in those days, especially during the Depression and in the war years. A real treat would be to have a taffy pull, which didn't happen very often, which was always great fun. The milk was so rich then that the cream would rise to the top and one never had to buy cream to whip. One made one's own ice cream and sherbet in a churn, each taking a turn at the handle.
Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Norley White, and I'd like you, to let you know that you gave us quite a unique perspective, and it's been great talking with you. I'm now speaking with Mr. John Brock. We're going to talk a little bit about his family's history, the Brock history.
My father's family were English. His father was English, and he emigrated at the age of 21 from London to St. John because he was offered a job. He was in the dry goods business in England, and some of the MRA travelers met him there and said there was a job in St. John with the London House, which was a store at the top of King Street. So he came out with a bride, and he later got into the wholesale dry goods business with a partner on King Street, and he moved to Rossay in 1892. He married a Scottish woman, which makes me a quarter English and a quarter Scotch. My mother was born in Dublin from Irish-Canadian Protestant parents who were visiting her home at the time. And she learned to walk on the way out from the ship, so it makes me half Irish. My father went into business after his father died in the same wholesale dry goods business, and they moved to Rossay in 1892. My grandfather lost one child to diphtheria, and he thought it was the sanitary conditions in St. John, where open wells were below downhill from septic tanks, and he didn't think much of that, so he wanted to get to the country. The children, of course, were all born in Rossay or in hospitals in St. John, some of them. My father was involved in the wholesale dry goods business, as I've said, and I followed him after the Second World War and worked there for a while. The type of business was selling to general stores throughout the Maritime Provinces. We had about 15 travelers on the road, and it was unhappily a dying business. The manufacturers started to go direct to the retailer and skipped the wholesaler. The business was eventually sold to Gordon Mackay and Company of Toronto, and I left at that time. and went on my own on the road on commission, selling the same type of merchandise. The Gordon MacKay went out of business in about 5 years, and there was only probably one wholesale dry goods house left in Canada. At one time, there were 15 of them in St. John. My father, as I recall, was very family orientated, and he always took us on tours to go fishing and hunting birds, ducks, and partridges. And he bought us a boat when we were pretty young, and we took up sailing. I played golf when I was 13, and then my father bought this boat for my brother and I. He paid $150 for a 28-foot sloop. She drew 5 feet 3 inches of water, and she would sleep three small boys upriver quite comfortably. She had 350 square feet of sail, all for $150. Today, a boat, the price of fiberglass boats today is reckoned at about $1,000 a foot. We sailed a lot. We always went upriver every year with the Royal Kennebecasis Yacht Club cruise. And we had other cruises. Rossi Yacht Club consisted of about 5 or 6 sailboats, all owned by boys of my age group. And we raced with the RKYC and among ourselves very often. We inherited an old building which was called the Rossi Boat Club Limited, and the older generation, like my father and Mr. Rupert Turnbull, sort of passed control over to us and said, do what you like with it. We moved the clubhouse back about 40 feet to get it on a little higher ground to avoid the spring freshet, because water would come up over the floor in the spring. It has since been moved again and rebuilt, but the original timbers, I think, are still part of the present building. The summer in those school days, a lot of people played tennis, and the routine was to go down in the morning and play tennis or golf, and then walk down the tracks to the wharf and have a swim. And any fine summer day, this was the action. We used to have a few dances, and we had a very pleasant childhood. The name of the boat that we owned was called Junco, and she was built in Port Hawkesbury, Nova Scotia. And at that time, there was only one other boat owner of our generation, and that was Eric Blanchette. And he had a small 18-foot flat-bottom fast boat with 2 lee boards, very wet sailor. The next year, Mr. Sayre bought Jeff and Jack Sayre a friendship sloop. She was a big, heavy-set boat, a sloop with a topsail. And Jim Bouguer built a boat called the Whistler, up in the Washtamoik, where they had a summer farm. And she joined the fleet. And David Armstrong and Hugh Armstrong owned a boat called the Adaran. And gradually the fleet increased through the years until the war came on, and then, of course, everything all went to pieces. We spent a lot of time on the river. We explored every creek and branch of the St. John River, from the creeks in Musquash Island and Long Island and Yarramatto, and went to Fredericton quite often. After the Second World War, about 1948, I think it was, Joe Steele and I went into partnership and bought a boat by the name of Canada. She was built in 1898, so she was 50 years old when we bought her. We had to put some floor timbers in, but she was in pretty good shape. She was rather a famous boat for racing in the old days, and she was a sloop. the main boom that went 14 feet out over the stern. But when we bought her, she had been scaled down and didn't carry nearly as much sail as in her racing days, and she was re-rigged as a Marconi yawl. We cruised in her, took holidays, and that first summer we decided to have a party in Kingston Creek because she was to celebrate her 50th birthday. And we invited about 70 people who came by boat, by car, and we had quite a hilarious swimming party, and we didn't serve any food, but people bought picnic lunches and so on. And poor old boat was pretty well down to the waterline, or down to the gunwales by the time all this crowd came and went. We continued that for 3 more years. And then Joe decided that we should buy a farm over in the Kingston Peninsula, and I went along with that, so we, you might say, we traded the boat in for a manure spreader.
We took up skiing at a pretty early age in Rosse, just a handful of us, George McAvity, my brother Fred and I, Frank Ham, Tim Ellis, and rather than walk to school when there was snow, we skied across the Taylor Field from Maiden Lane and up the old Laundry Road to the school. And then we'd ski home for lunch, back after lunch, ski home at night. So we did quite a bit of skiing. Of course, on the way home at night, we'd stay on the little hills there. We had one called Big Taylor and one called Little Taylor. And we learned the turns. There were very few skiers around in those days. And sometimes somebody moving in from Quebec or Ontario would be more expert than we were, and we would learn something from them. We skied across the river in the wintertime, looking for bigger hills, and we went on the island just below the minister's face, and then we'd ski across the island on an old wood road, which is still there, and we would arrive at Johnny Jordan's farm, and then go down the island a little way, and then across the other side of the river to the area of Chapel Grove, the White Head. And there were some nice hills there. And this would take all day Saturday. We'd take a lunch with us. And the skiing wasn't much fun on the river. It was so flat. It was rather boring. We skated a lot on the river. I remember after the war, I made a point for a number of years of making sure that once during the river I skated around the island. We had ice boats. My brother Fred was very handy with carpentry tools. And we built an ice boat, two or three ice boats. And so did Jeff Sayre and George McAvity. And we'd race. And in the evening, after school, we'd tack down to Riverside, Renforth, and we'd race the evening train that arrived in Rosse at 5:45. And sometimes we'd beat the train, but of course it had to stop in East Riverside. Fishing on the river, we did a little bit of it. It was more popular then, I think, than it is now. Hake and smelt. I didn't ever get very much excitement out of that, but I did some of it.
There seems to be a lot more fish.
I don't know whether there are more fish or fewer fish. Smelt run in with a run on, and then you get nothing. I've never figured out. Some people say they come in with a flood tide. But I think they're smaller than they used to be, perhaps. But I really can't say. I think there are more hake now than they used to be. There are, it's said, some holes in the deep part of the river where there's some unusual fish. Like some scientists from St. Andrews investigated one time, and they found a hole down near the bottom of the island, and very heavy salt content lying in the hole, and they caught a halibut down there, which, of course, is a deep-sea fish. We tried from the sailboats to troll a line over, but we I never caught anything that way. It seems that a lot of fish won't take a lure when there's salt in the water. And, of course, the river is tidal to Evandale, so it's brackish water and not fresh. And certainly salmon won't take a fly. I've tried many times when they were jumping off my cottage at Chambers Bluff. We did some driving on the river. We took chances, I'm afraid. I wouldn't do it today. But it was great sport to... I remember one fellow who went to RCS. He lost a car in one of the tide rips. There were about three tide rips in the vicinity of Rossay where the ice buckles through the expansion and contraction from the sun and the freezing at night. And the ice buckles up, and you had to be careful where you cross these tide rips, whether you're skating or driving. And this fellow made a mistake, parked his car near the minister's face, and the ice broke away near the tide rip, and he stepped out. It was a convertible car, and he stepped out on the dry ice, and everybody beat that, but he lost his car. And he sold the car on the bottom of the river for $100, and it was a pretty fancy model Ford, and fairly new. And a character by the name of Ozzy Saunders from Gone to Point hooked it with a grapnel, and then cut a channel from there to the shore, and pulled it in with some kind of power. And he sold the car to George Crosby, who told it for quite a few years until the war broke out.
That's a neat story. You mentioned ice boats. Could you describe them for me, Dale?
Well, first ice boats we built were pretty primitive. Not like they are today. They consisted of a 3-inch plank about 10 inches wide as a cross piece, and there were skates on each end of this. And then the longitudinal, the fore and aft member, was a tree or a 4x4 or a 4x6. And you stepped the mast on that. And it had stays. Well, I'm afraid we stole some fence wire somewhere and used that for stays. And we had an old sail, maybe from the yacht, but we made our own sail, too. My mother was pretty good on a sewing machine. And the back skate, you could turn it, that's what you steered by, and you had a tiller, just like a boat, and a little platform on the back where you lay on your stomach. I would think it's probably the coldest sport in the world, because an ice boat would go pretty fast, and you're going tacking against the wind, and the temperature might be well below freezing. It would be well below freezing, maybe down to zero. And you could freeze yourself pretty fast, so you wore fur hats and extra warm clothing. No, there were not a lot of ice boats. There was a man by the name of Banks who lived in Rossay who had one, and he kept it at Rossay Wharf, and we kept ours down on Sandy Beach. And I remember later on the Grant built one, and there were several more. Sometimes they wouldn't get on the ice. Every winter was different. But sometimes you wouldn't get good skating on the river, and there'd be snow all the time. But whenever we could, we got the ice boats out. It was very rough. Most of the time, you were all shook up by the time you finished the day's ice boating, and very cold. But you would break them. You could break the main piece or the cross piece in a high wind, and we were forever repairing them and mending the sail and trying out new skates. And it was a good sport. Very cold.
Mm-hmm. What about swimming?
Well, there were, I think I mentioned before, they used to go from the tennis club and swim every morning. That is the younger generation who were holidaying. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there was swimming every Sunday after church. It seemed to be a custom. People would walk out of St. Paul's Church and walk down to the wharf to see what was going on, and the young people would all change and go for a swim. The water, I think, was a little cleaner then, although there was a direct sewer line in the harbor across it. Generally speaking, I think the water was cleaner. Before the city of St. John dumped half their sewage up the river.
Okay. Any funny things going on in the practice? Trying, you recall people trying to swim and not doing the best? There were no instructions.
No.
No? No funny at all.
Well.
Tell me what.
We had some nervous old ladies in the village, and the boys used to bait them at the end of the wharf when they were observing the swimming. They'd have a rowboat, and they'd upset it and turn and leave it upside down and tie it to the wharf. And then they'd dive off, and these old dolls would be watching them, and they wouldn't come up because they would come up inside the rowboat where there was an airspace. And they'd breathe there for 4 or 5 minutes, and the old dolls would get pretty frantic.
Oh, little characters. Okay. What about fishing, shooting, and camping on the river and those muskrats?
When I was very young, my father initiated me into muskrat trapping. It was a very brief career I had. We walked down to the trestle where the Taylor Brook joins the river on the railway. And the railway workers used to renew telephone poles, and they would just leave the old one there, and it might extend out into the water inside in the brook part of the estuary there. And the thing was to set a trap at the end of this so you could walk out and see how you were doing. And I think he paid $2 for two traps, or $2 each for two traps, and we set them. There was a colony of Indians in my childhood that lived on the point in the extreme south of Rosse, now called Kinghurst Point, I think.
Below. Dominic Nellie Francis?
Yeah, well, you've heard of those,
right? I've heard of them.
Okay. So we always suspected the Indians of being a little on the shady side, and the first time I set my muskrat traps with my father, he used to catch the train for work in the morning at 8:15, and so, and before I went to school, he and I went down to check on the trap, and we had one muskrat that had been caught, but the muskrat chewed its leg off, which was a habit they had, and escaped. And the next time we went down, both the traps were gone. We presumed that they had muskrats in them, and we blamed the Indians for stealing them. So my muskratting career was over.
Short and sweet.
We also put, my father and Mr. Steele had a shad net, which they put off Blair's Point, which is the north end of Sandy Beach. And they put it out for, no, not shad, Gaspereau. But we would tend that before they caught the train. And mostly we would catch suckers. And we didn't eat suckers. And the father told us to take them home. And we buried them on the back lawn under the apple trees for fertilizer. And we had the Gaspereau to eat.
What about camping? What was camping like back then?
I didn't do much tenting, although there were scout camps on Long Island. I wasn't in the scout business, but my brother was, and I can remember going over with my family by motorboat, hired a motorboat to go over to see how Fred was making out in the camp. Camping to me was camps that my father was interested in. He and Mr. McAvity and Mr. Davidson owned a camp at Dunham's Wharf on the St. John River, which they used for whistler shooting in the fall and black duck shooting. And they also owned a camp on the Norton Shore beyond Hampton off the Pickwocket Road. And this was strictly a black duck camp, and we wouldn't up there on Saturday afternoon and have the evening shoot, a big feed of beans, and drive home. Or we would stay the night. There were bunks on the side, and it was pretty exciting for small boys. When I first went, of course, I wasn't allowed to shoot a gun, but when I was 13 or so, we all owned guns. We all knew quite a lot about boats. We spent a lot of time in those camps. We shot a lot more ducks than we can shoot today.
What about Jeff Kearse's blacksmith shop?
Well, Jeff Kearse's blacksmith shop was a wonder for a small boy. There'd be a couple of horses tied outside and one inside getting shod, I guess it is. John?
Shooed.
Having shooed, yeah.
That's it.
It was a wonderful antique shop of things hanging on every wall, and old calendars, and bits of metal, and an earthen floor. And, of course, the most fascinating thing was the fire, which was very hot, and it had bellows that you had to turn by hand to make give extra heat, and there would be a horseshoe on some kind of a pair of pliers in the coals, getting red hot or white hot. And if you knew Jeff, he'd let you turn the bellows, and this was quite a thrill. And he would take this red-hot shoe and dip it in cold water after he had shoot it, and pick up one of the horse's hooves and nail it on. And it always amazed me that the horse never seemed to flinch, because didn't understand how you get nailed to somebody's foot.
Okay, what about recollections of RCS? There must be so many things.
Too many?
Yeah. I guess you boys used to run down after those poor women all the time.
Oh, well, that's
Netherwood, and Miss Ganong would have quite a frightful feelings about that. Were you ever one of the boys who went up the fire escape?
There was no boy in Kings County that had never been up the Netherwood fire escape, I don't think.
Tell me about, okay, but I guess they went to church, and that would be the one time you got to see the ladies in the church.
That's right. Well, yeah. Well, you got the same one?
Okay.
I went from a public school in Rossi from grade 5 into Form 2A at RCS in 1929, and that was the last year of the old schoolhouse. This was an old, very old wooden building. There was a central hall with a dais in the middle with a chair on it where the master sat, and he could look through the windows of about 5 classrooms and see what was going on with just a glance. And the floors were very worn, with the deep ruts in them where they'd been worn through the years by countless boys. Next year we had a brand new brick schoolhouse, which is still in use today as a schoolhouse, with a proper gymnasium behind it. We had two rather very old houses which accommodated the boys, the North House and the South House. Still standing, and also some boys lived in them with masters. Mr. Dew took in a couple of boys, and Mr. Coster, alongside the North House, boarded 3 or 4 boys.
Who was the headmaster?
Headmaster, all my time in RCS was Dr. Hibbard, who was an Anglican minister, and he was a very good teacher.
What was the
And I left RCS. I went in 29, and I graduated in 1935. Mm-hmm. School activities, there were a lot of sports. There was a cadet corps, of course. We played football in the fall, a little bit of soccer. After the football season, some of us went to the woods and cut firewood, in hardwood and softwood in 4-foot lengths and split it. Mr. Dew would come along with his measuring stick and estimate the cordage and pay us $3 a cord for softwood and
$4 a cord for hardwood and $3.50 for mixed soft and hard. We had a trick whereby you would pile the logs very carefully so there were lots of air spaces, and if you gave the pile a good shake, it might shake down to about 3/4 of a cord, but we got paid for the cord. There was hockey in the wintertime. I wasn't involved in hockey because I was skiing. And, of course, in the spring brought all the track sports. We always had big track meets, interscholastic track meets, and RCS always did very well. Better, I think, at track than in other sports. I must realize we were competing with Fredericton High School and St. John High School, St. John Vocational School, St. Vincent's, all of which had a very much larger number of boys to choose from. We were very small. There would be maybe 120 at school when I was there, and of course some were very small boys who couldn't get involved in senior sports. So we didn't have very many people, and we had to, from that, choose a basketball team, a football team, a hockey team, a track team, whereas a school like St. John High had hundreds of boys. But we did compulsory sports, and a lot of them didn't take part in any sports at all. So I suppose that they had an advantage from having more, but it wasn't as many more as
perhaps.
Country
boys were more athletic, I think. What was an average day like in your subjects? What subjects did you
take? Well, we took all the subjects, plus a few that they didn't take in public schools. For instance, in mathematics we took, but we also took calculus. And in the arts, we studied Latin, which wasn't taught in public school. Later on, Latin became voluntary. They also, of course, offered in German. Very few people studied German. There was French, better French than in the public schools. The advantage of the boy at the private school like that was that the classes were very small, and the teacher could give undivided attention, give a lot of attention to every boy personally. And also there was a compulsory study period every evening, every weekday evening, and overseen by a master, and you weren't allowed to draw pictures, or you had to put your nose in the book and do some work.
Were you a day person or a boarder?
I was a day boy all the time. I was at RCS, but in some private schools, the day boys don't get much of a look in, but at RCS, you were accepted to join in any activities yourself. Of course, you missed a lot of the fun in the evening and so on when you were at home, but you felt very much a part of the school as day boys. And you got just about what you put into it. If you wanted to be in sports, you could do as much sports as a day boy as the boarders could.
Was there any particular teachers that you can remember that were kind of masters? I suppose we went over them, but you took chemistry and you took your English and all that, didn't you?
Yes. thinking back on the masters, two or three stand out. One was a fellow by the name of Cooper, who was about the age of the headmaster, and he was an Englishman. We called him Cha Cooper. Every master had a nickname. And he was a doddering old schoolmaster type, sort of goodbye Mr. Chips type. And I'm afraid we made a lot of fun of him and played tricks on him too often, but he's a nice old gentleman. He was a friend of my father's, bachelor. And when he died, he left his father $25 to be split between us two boys, because he used to have a lot of free lunches down at our house, afternoon tea on Sundays. Another master was Mr. Keeble, who stayed with the school a good many years. He was a Church of England minister, so he was sort of padre at the school, looked after the chapel, and taught, among other things, Latin, which most people didn't like. So he wasn't very popular, but your attitude that changed toward masters, for instance, We had another master called Lester Jackson, who during the war, when Mr. Bonnycastle went away from the Navy, he was made the, I think they called him joint master, or headmaster at least. He was on an equal basis with Dr. Bonnycastle. Anyway, he was a very, very good mathematics teacher, and he could impart this, but he was very severe, and we were afraid of him. He was tough, and he didn't let anybody get away with anything. I think some of us were a little afraid of him.
What kind of discipline system was there?
Well, discipline was a question of detention. If you made misdemeanors, you were sentenced to a quarter of an hour, or a half an hour, or maybe 2 hours for something serious. And then you had to go in Saturday afternoon or in the evenings and work off your detention periods. And if you got too many detentions, you had it strapped off by the headmaster or one of the other masters. Strapping was not frequent, but quite often if somebody would be up for a strap. They laid it on pretty hard on your hand. It wasn't really painful. I think your feelings were hurt more than your hand.
What were some of the pranks that were played? Towards the teachers or the girls or anything going on like that?
Oh, I was talking about the masters. I'm sorry. I missed the point there. Two masters, Keeble, when you went back to the school after you graduated to visit for the weekend or just to drop in and say hello, it was always either Keeble or Jackson that you asked for. And the boys who didn't like Jackson school realized when they matured a little bit and they were in university that he was the best of the lot that far. And they went back and told him they appreciated that he had been tough with them. They figured that the discipline that he gave them had stood them in good stead. So he was very popular when you went back to the school.
As much as that. What about the pranks?
Oh, well,
I can't remember.
I think they boys weren't involved in pranks of masters and so on, because it happened more at night in the dormitories, and I don't remember that we were in on much, or I can't. I'm sure there were pranks around the classroom, but I can't recall many of them at the moment. There was always problem with the girls' school in the village, Netherwood. It was off limits, but of course everybody sneaked in there, and we climbed the fire escape and worry. Miss Ganong, Susie Ganong, she was called the headmistress. She lived on Maiden Lane. A little history there. My aunt, A.L. Brock, was a maiden lady, and she lived on this street, which was called Morris Avenue. I think Morris was the man who surveyed the village originally. And there were two ladies, sisters, one of whom taught at Netherwood. They were the Mrs. Pitcher, P-I-T-C-H-E-R. So that made four maiden ladies living on Morris Avenue. So the town changed, it was popularly called Maiden Lane. And so the town changed it officially to Maiden Lane in later years.
Wasn't that neat? That's how that came about, and stuck ever since. Yeah. What about...
We used to bother the Netherwood girls, but I can remember particularly on Halloween night, George Macready's father, and he asked his father to get him a cow's horn, and he stopped in at the abattoir and brought out this horn from a newly spotted cow that was hollowed out, and he put a hole in the tip of it and filled it full of oakum. And we took down the Netherwood on Halloween night, and we blew through the end when the oakum was on fire, and it produced a wonderful bunch of smoke. And there was a terrible tar odor in it from the oakum, and we pretty well filled the school there with the smoke.
Okay, tell me about... Okay, getting off now, but I think we pretty much covered it. What about your chores in your family? What were some things you had to do?
Well, family chores were quite an item in those days. First of all, we had a wood stove in the kitchen. And we bought wood in stove lengths, but it had to be split. Well, first of all, it had to be thrown in from where it was dumped in the back lawn through a cellar window. And then through the winter, it had to be split. And you had to keep ahead of that. My brother and I would take turns to do it jointly. And we always had to keep the wood box full for the front fireplace and for the kitchen. And we also had to have a stock of kindling on hand. Anything that would bust up into small pieces, used for kindling. And we had to bring this upstairs, of course. Later, we had an oil stove with a big oil bottle with a barrel in the basement. And we'd have to fill the oil bottle every 3 or 4 days and carry it up. We had a coal furnace, and we burned hard coal, Welsh anthracite, which was trucked out from town, or there was a coal car came in down by the wharf on one of the sidings. And Bob Scovel would, and another man, I've forgotten who it was, would deliver the coal, and with a horse and sleigh, a horse and a wagon, and shoot it into the cellar with a coal chute, and then we would have to keep the fire going. The fire went out, Father would start it, but then it was our job. My brother Fred and I would come home from school at noon and tend the fire. At night after school, tend the furnace and shake down the ashes and shovel them out from under into a coal scuttle and carry them outside. At that point, they had been laying alongside our house in Goldie Court, sir, on the Maiden Lane, which was called Morton's Lane, which is now Goldie Court. Mr. Morton lived at the end, and he was the only house on the lane besides the side of our house, which driveway went out to Goldie Court. So we just dumped the ashes on the road and raked them, and we built a beautiful road there through the years. Ashes make a great base for a road. That was quite a chore, lugging that around, especially in the deep snow. And then the other chore was looking after the hens. We always had about 15 hens, and the hens had to be fed twice a day and watered regularly. Particularly in the wintertime, the water would freeze, and the father would be very annoyed if he came home from a day's work and inspected the hen house and found that the water bucket for the hens was frozen over and the poor things were trying to choke down some bran or something dry and couldn't get any water to help it along. We did the usual chores, of course, of mowing the lawn and trimming the hedges in the summertime, but we were paid 25 cents a week normally, but for mowing the lawn, we got 25 cents an hour. It took about 4 hours to mow the lawn. Old-fashioned push-type lawnmower, and the small boy was quite a chore, and I suppose the lawns could be done in 2 hours by a man, but it took us about 4 hours.
Tell me, what
about
refrigeration?
Oh, we didn't own a refrigerator until the war years. We had a tin ice chest in the basement, and the ice man brought ice once a week.
No,
I don't remember the ice man's name. The ice was cut with saws out in Dolan's Lake, and sometimes on the Kennebecasis River, and destroyed in ice hen houses with sawdust and last all summer. We had a lot of tradesmen come to the door in those days. There was the fish man, Mr. Gilliland from Fairvale. Of course, the milkman came every day. The meat man came once a week, Butch Dixon. And the bread man, Eastern Bakery, he came with the bread and all the sweet cakes and cookies and stuff like that. And I don't know whether any more door people or not, but groceries we bought mostly locally. Our father shopped for meat in the market in John because his office was close to the market. The rest of the stuff we tried to split between the two general stores, Mr. Diggle's store and Lou Merritt's on Rossay Corner.
Is there anything else that you'd like to
add?
Things that you feel
are
important that should be?
Well, off the top of my head, I'm sure there are, but I can't think of them right at the moment.
Well, that's just to give me an excuse to come back. Thank you very much, Mr. Buck.
You're very welcome.
So, Buck, you have a little more to add about the trains and travel. Why don't you tell me about that?
The train was pretty important to residents of Rossay. Because people traveled by train. There were no buses in my childhood. And everybody commuted by train. So you got a card for the month. And I think the fare worked out to about 12 cents a trip. And you caught the train at 8:15 in the morning, which put you on Dock Street by 8:45. Time to walk to the office. And it was a social hour, or a social half hour. There was a boy that sold newspapers, and you might buy a morning paper. And the people get on from Hampton down to commute to St. John, and that was from Sisyphus and Fairvale, and the train stopped at Kinghurst and East Riverside. I think it stopped at Brookville, too. And the Hampton crowd would get a card game going every morning. I think they played 45. And some people just chatted. You met the same people every day, so you got to know people all along the line. And it was quite a lot of fun. And the train at night, there were two. One came up to them, traveled the most, was arrived in Rossay at 5:45. And my father always walked to the train. It wasn't very far from Maiden Lane to the railway station. I think most people walked, but some people owned horses, and the people like the Fairweathers who did a little farming, they would be driven to the station by a fancy rig. Mackay's had horses, Allison's had horses, and all these people traveled rather grandly in their buggies, I suppose. And they were met when the train came in at night. It was about a 30-minute ride, but of course there were 4 or 5 stops on the way. And so the train never could get up steam before it had to start to break down to the next station stop. So it didn't go 25 miles an hour on an average, I don't suppose. So it would take about 30 minutes to get to Union Station in St. John.
How many stops are there?
I mentioned stops.
What type of train was it?
It carried the milk, picked up the milk at all stations in between, like Bloomfield. And, started with Sussex, and it would bring milk into the dairies in St. John. Every farmer would be down at the station with 2 or 3 milk cans, and they'd be loaded aboard in a baggage car and delivered to the dairies in the city. They'd also carry the mail, and all the rest of the passenger cars. There'd be about 4 or 5 passenger cars, an express car, baggage car.
There were train wrecks. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, I can remember one train wreck, which was in the vicinity of the wharf, I think. But it wasn't very serious. Several cars were off the track. It wasn't as bad as the one we had a few years ago here. But my father told a good story about a wreck on a Sunday morning, which happened near the culvert, north of the culvert, in the vicinity of the tennis court road. And he lived in a house on the main road, the corner of the main road and the tennis court road. And from his bedroom in the third floor, he could look, see the river. There weren't as many trees as there are today. He looked out over the tennis court, and he could see the railway tracks. And he said he was shaving on Sunday morning when he was a boy, and he saw this train get off the tracks, and the cars were upended and rolling over, and most of the train was off the track. And this train was taking immigrants to Western Canada,
and cattle. And the poor cows were all over the place with broken legs and so on. And they had to be shot. And Dad recalls dropping his razor and running as fast as he could through the wreck. And I say that the cars were tumbled over. Well, I don't think it was that serious, but I'm not sure that there were. I don't think there were many people hurt, mostly cattle. And he says that they got a gun from somewhere to put the cattle out of their misery. And this Englishman with a pronounced Cockney accent was instructing. He must have been a farmer in England, although I don't know how he could be a farmer in a Cockney, but anyway, he had a strong accent. Yeah, whoever had the rifle, he said to him as he was aiming, hit him between the lug and the ear. No, the lug and the horn. Hit him between the lug and the horn. Well, the lug apparently was the ear. But he knew how to shoot an animal anyway. Apparently you'd hit him in the brain if you hit him there.
Well, is that pretty much all you want? Great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. This is Miss Evelyn Brock. This is Evelyn Brock, and she's going to talk a little bit about her family. And I'll say, now, can you tell me a bit about how the nickname, I believe it's for John Brock, might have come about? There's a rumor going on about how it went on.
Well, as far as I know, when he was a child and he tapped his hand saying, Paddocky, Paddocky, it came out as Paddocky, Paddocky, and he's been called Tanner as a nickname ever since.
Oh, I see. Now, Mrs. Brock, you were saying, had a nickname also.
Her name was, well, everyone in the village called her Boo because her nieces and nephews called her Auntie Moo because her name is Muriel. And it, I don't know how it happened, but it developed into Boo with the next generation, and all my children called her Boo. And my daughter named her first kitten after her. It was Boo. So there were a lot of nicknames in this village. People were growing up. It seemed to be the thing to do. Call everyone by a nickname.
What about sailing?
Well, my husband Fred has sailed all his life. He was taught sailing, I think, as a very young boy by Skipper Turnbull. He was a skipper, and Mr. Brock Sr. used to sail together. And then the boys, I think Tanner or John, used to go too. But I do know for sure that Fred learned, and he always said he learned to sail at the helm, at least Skipper Turnbull was at the helm. So, and he just loved the sea. It was just part of his life. He had to be on the water. And years gone by, it's just been a marvelous relaxation. He just gets away from everything, and he's a very energetic. He was a very energetic man, and he knew every single area of the river. He can say it all. He liked to gauge Wolf, far beyond gauge time. He used to go up to watch the Moors and Grand Lake. So all in all, he had. It was one of his hobbies. He also did a lot of shooting, just ducks. And fishing, of course, and she went to, you wanted to go back farther, don't you, in his youth?
Whatever.
And, of course, I wasn't around then, but he had, I think, to my way of thinking, he had a wonderful childhood, just a marvelous childhood living in here, living in Rossay, because it's just because it is a small area, and there were not all that many people living here then. Everybody knew everybody and everything about everybody, which I must say I found a little hard when I first came here. Anyway, they knew every time we even went to the post office. But very friendly people, very good people, I think, in those days.
Mm-hmm. And buildings that you remember that have been taken down?
Well, the community house, of course, was taken down. And, as I said before, the Steels could tell you a lot more about that than I can. But I know they used to, and old Dickel's store, they all used to congregate there, and all the young people used to go and sit on the platform or whatever, yeah, in front of the store and get candy. I think we even have pictures everywhere in some place. Anyway, of the old store as it was in those days. And of course, it was a grocery store on the phone, right across from Diggle's. where there is, what's it now, it's a hairdresser and whatever Lawton Geist was, I think it's played in.
They're about the only buildings.
Yeah, no, that's downtown Rosse.
What were some of the people you knew personally? They were friends with when you'd been friends. What were some people that you knew?
Well, the Cosbys, Allie and George Cosby, Bowen Steele. George and Betty McAvity were very good friends, but they moved away, and George was, George's father was Clifford McAvity, and he sold McAvity's plant, and so George moved to Sinai, and did another thing. But they all grew up together. Tim Ellis and Fred were great friends. The Ellis's just lived down in the lane, and that's it. And he was another good friend of Betty. And they had a really good childhood, an outdoor childhood. And I remember stories about one of them, in particular, when Freddie said he used to get up awfully early. And he went down, he'd have traps, the same as his brother John had, down, just before you get to the yacht club, there's a bridge there. Mm-hmm. And he used to set his traps there. And he said, one morning he went out, and he was just putting a head to the next rock. And all of a sudden, he heard his voice saying, be careful, young man, you're going to fall in. And it was his father. He was only a youngster at the time. But these are the kind of things they could do in those days, living in a small town like this.
A lot of backyards, little paths, and
that's right, yeah. And Mrs. Brock was a chimney. She was a real character. Everyone in the life knew her. Marvelous sense of humor. And a real disciplinarian, too. I mean, my children all knew when they went there that they had to be with her. They told me that they loved her. Just adored her. Yeah, they respected her. Very much so. She had a marvelous...